In many ways, one of the roles that I played prior to COVID was really talking to people about how telemedicine, it's not a new specialty, it's not like a thing. You know, it is another modality that you can use to practice medicine.
Welcome to the Redox Podcast. I'm your host, Nico Skivaski, co-founder and president of Redox, where we are on a mission to make healthcare data useful and in turn enable the frictionless adoption of technology in healthcare. The Redox Podcast explores the intersection between healthcare and technology. How is tech making a difference? What are the barriers to adoption, and how are they being overcome? We talk to some of our industry's brightest minds, up-and-coming technologists, and health tech legends that have paved the way for what's to come. One thing is certain, healthcare will change dramatically over the coming years. My hope is that you'll leave these conversations with a bit more context, along with a jolt of optimism to continue working for a better healthcare. With that in mind, I welcome you to the Redox Podcast. Welcome to another episode of the Redox Podcast. With us today is Dr. Sylvia Rahm, who is the Chief Innovation Officer at Atlantic Health System, a 7-hospital organization based in northern New Jersey. In addition to being a pediatrician, she's also an avid author and speaker in healthcare and health tech policy. Prior to Atlantic Health, Dr. Rahm previously served as VP of Clinical Transformation with Amwell. It just so happens that Redox's Chief Customer Officer, Alif Arajar, who many of you have likely had the chance to meet, worked with Dr. Rahm at Amwell as that company grew to dominance as the largest video-based telehealth company in the U.S. I thought it'd be great to let these old friends catch up, talk virtual care in the time of COVID-19, and where care delivery is going in the future. And with that, I'd love to welcome Alif interviewing Dr. Rahm on the Redox Podcast.
Our guest today is a good friend of mine, Dr. Sylvia Rahm, the Chief Innovation Officer at Atlantic Health System. On a personal side, in addition to our passion for telehealth, Sylvia and I also share a passion for sailing. Sylvia, welcome to the Redox Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's so great to be connected again.
I know. I feel the same way. Let's start with, you know, kind of going back to your education and career a little bit. Tell us about your journey from like pediatric hospitalist to an innovator in technology side of medicine.
Yeah, you know, the way that I usually refer to it is as a non-linear path. talk about sailing too. It's like you learn that, you know, you don't always go just like straight from point A to point B. There's a lot of like tacking. And that's life, right? So I actually, even before I went to medical school, I didn't know that I wanted to go into medicine until a little bit later in life. And so I did research first, which I think is actually really important because, you know, I did years of bench work of testing hypotheses. And so I think that really, I really pulled that into when I started doing medicine, really thinking about not just what we were learning and you know, sort of like the book studies in front of us, but what is it that we don't know that we haven't tried? How can we think about how what we are doing can be done differently and, you know, maybe even better in some cases? When I looked at the world around us, it had changed so much from when I had entered training to when I had exited. And the way that we practice medicine hadn't really changed a whole ton. And so I wanted to think about how we could use new technologies to increase access to care, improve the consumer experience or the patient experience in what we were doing, and just generally make the whole process of receiving medical care and maintaining health to be a lot easier. And so I went to telemedicine, found that the patients that I worked with really, really loved it, were really, really grateful and appreciative for being able to reach me. And so then after trying it out for a bit, I decided to move into it full time and kind of went on from there.
Right. And the one aspect that I love is you founded Milk on Tap. And as mother of two who had actually had trouble, you know, and I use a lot of lactation consultants, you know, at Mass General, this, you know, having this niche telemedicine company that focused on the needs of nursing mothers is incredible. So tell us more about that, how it led you to American Well as well.
Yeah. So as a pediatrician, I knew that many new mothers needed help with breastfeeding and that it was one of those things that the way that we've structured support in this area is often that breastfeeding lactation consultants, you know, are generally available sort of Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. And it turns out when you have a new baby, they don't just eat Monday through Friday.
Right? Like, I wish,
right? In fact, they kind of never stop. And if you are having a problem breastfeeding, you really only have a few hours to figure it out. Otherwise, it's harmful for the mom or for the baby. And so I had already been doing pediatric urgent care with a company kind of, you know, ad hoc. And then when I had my second son and realized like how, you know, just reminded of how big of a deal it was, I wanted to apply the skills that I'd learned in using telemedicine to see patients on my own to new parents who were having issues or questions around breastfeeding. And so started a company that was called Milk on Tap, is now Consolidated Health because we expanded into doing nutrition support as well. Got it off the ground. And pretty soon after we launched, American Well, Amwell approached us and said, look, you know, we're looking at for new programs for working moms. Can you be a subcontractor for us? Can you supply those programs for us as we're building them out? And I was just like, absolutely, this sounds great. I'd love to be able to expand these services to more women. And then sort of worked in that you know, partnership role for a while before, you know, eventually had a really great working relationship with Amwell. And, you know, they said, like, why don't you just come on full time? And, you know, initially started off as a medical director, but pretty quickly moved from being a medical director for the provider group that provides care on Amwell to really thinking about strategy and implementation around how do we help some of our clients realize the potential of how they could use digital health and also build digital health as another tool in the way for meeting the strategic goals. And in fact, it's usually a very important tool. So kind of, you know, moved on from there to a much more strategy/ops.
So it's no secret that you've been a huge fan of telehealth before it was even popular like it is today, right? It's incredible that it seems to have taken a pandemic to open people's eyes. So how do you see the advantages and disadvantages of virtual provider?
You know, it's really amazing. So Atlantic Health System, where I'm now Chief Innovation Officer, and I look at digital health in our digital front door and how I provide care. In many ways, one of the roles that I played prior to COVID was really talking to people about how telemedicine is not, it's not a new specialty. It's not like a thing. It is a way of, you know, it is another modality that you can use to practice medicine. And so, you know, one of the things I've said before is like, look, I don't say I practice stethoscope. I say I practice medicine, right? Like, because it is a modality for me to collect information from the person I'm taking care of. And using video, using phone is another way to do that. And so for many ways, it was just getting people to start trying it within their practices and giving the people that they care for different options, additional options to be able to get care. And then all of a sudden, we moved into practices literally from like a Friday to a Monday, switching all of their visits from in-person to telephone or video, like over a weekend. And so now I find myself in the interesting position of now hundreds or thousands really of providers at my health system have now tried it, have used it, have figured out places it works really well, have figured out places where it doesn't work as well, but have really started integrating it into the way that they think about care. And the way that happened, because it happened so quickly, we didn't yet have this centralized technical infrastructure to support everybody at scale in that way. And so because of that, and because of the waivers, many of our providers, you know, physicians and other providers who are providing care have used consumer technologies that a few months ago, you know, might not have been HIPAA, you know, that might have not been allowed under the HIPAA laws. They've used them and are actually quite happy with how easy they are to use. And so now pulling them back into the more regulatory laden, let's just say, infrastructure has been something that has been a very interesting and exciting challenge because we now have the demand from both the patients and the providers. And so now it is all about how do we create a good experience for both of them, which is, I actually think, a fantastic place to be in.
I love it. I think they were saying that from 2 years ago, it was only 18% of providers were using it. And now it's like 50%. Just firsthand, Mass General called us for my son's, you know, primary care visit for the, you know, that yearly visit to do the full checkup through video, and they use Zoom actually as well, just like you said, like the consumer technology as opposed to those purpose-built solutions out there. Yeah. So let's talk about a little bit on the provider and physician burnout. Do you think we've actually found a solution for physician burnout? And do you see, you know, how do you see telehealth helping with that?
To me, it's all about how it's applied. And so the way that I have seen telemedicine capabilities applied within practices vary everywhere from, we are going to give you the capacity to live wherever you want and, you know, see patients on your schedule, to, we are just adding this to your schedule and you're going to have to switch between modalities within a, you know, set block of time. Maybe even we're just going to give you extra patient visits. We're not even going to give you extra time. And so I have seen the absolute gamut from people saying it changed their lives. They were able to move away from high cost of living areas, or maybe they're able to move closer to elderly parents, or maybe they were able to have flexible schedules where they were able to see patients in the morning and in the afternoon, but could take the middle of the day off and really, really improve their lives. And I've seen it the opposite way, where it's not been a thought at all for the providers themselves. It's simply we want to figure out a way to create more widgets, you know, and they've layered on top. And so again, telemedicine is a tool. It's not a thing. And so how you use that tool is, and how thoughtfully you use that tool can really get different results.
You think it's going to provide a solution for the shortage as well? Like with, you know, we're now seeing these providers coming, right, the retired providers coming to help out with COVID. But I can, you know, you and I have seen, right, like retired physicians saying, hey, you know, when I'm retired, I can actually get on and start seeing some patients. Do you see like, it's going to be a solution for that as a tool?
Yeah, we have definitely seen that help out in different areas where, you know, different providers who were thinking about retiring and said, you know what, if I can move where I want in a place that, you know, has a lower cost of living and then see a certain number of patients a day, not have to travel into an office and do that. We've definitely seen providers extend their years into what otherwise have been retirement happen as well. In addition to that, you know, one of the things that we've looked at is areas where providers maybe don't want to move, or primary care physicians don't want to move. I think it's very difficult to entirely replace a primary care practice with telemedicine. But what you can do is if the patients don't need to come into the office for every visit, then it doesn't matter if they're a little bit further away. And so when you're planning out a region and you're thinking about how many primary care offices do we need in this region to have a sufficient network, you just don't need as many physical offices in as high a density, because there's a certain amount of volume that can be taken care of without having to be geographically bound to it. And so, you know, look, if I only have to go to my physician's office once a year, then it doesn't matter to me as much if they're 7 miles away or 10 miles away if I'm in a more rural area, right? And so then you can just sort of spread out the coverage that way.
Projecting care, right, to larger areas. That makes sense, 100%. Yeah. So you once said in an interview, and I quote, as healthcare as a whole moves to value-based care with a focus on prevention, being able to remove the barriers that prevent connections between patients and their providers will be paramount. So are we closer to that? Can you talk about that a bit more and the changes you're seeing in reimbursement, physician-patient relationship, and how providers are delivering care?
Yeah, it's actually one of the main reasons I came to Atlantic. Atlantic has really put forward value-based care as one of the areas that they're focused on and they do quite well on. And so that was really interesting to me, because a lot of what you can do with technology is this frequent touch with low barriers. So for example, if you are somebody with diabetes, you know, what you really need is you really need someone to touch base with you about your lifestyle and your life behaviors. And so doing that on a regular basis, maybe even multiple times a week, has been shown to get better outcomes than if you need to take a half a day off of work or, you know, wait in a waiting room, which nobody wants to do right now, and come into an office and maybe only do that every 2 weeks. So that frequency is really important, but you need to be able to do that in a way that doesn't entirely disrupt someone's life. And you can do that through using digital health in a way that's just not possible if you require somebody to come in person. There's two very interesting things going on right now. One is that the reimbursement from the government, and, you know, and CMS tends to set a lot of the reimbursement standards for everyone, has really changed since COVID has come into place. And so the fee-for-service world has changed dramatically. And in the value-based world, everyone's calculations as to how much they were going to spend on specific populations are just out the window, you know, in both directions, right? Because there are a lot of people who didn't get care that they were expecting to get, and so didn't have those expenses that they were expecting to have. And there are others that obviously had substantially greater expenses than you would have predicted, you know, just a few months ago. So now all of the contracts that were based on being able to predict like how much money people are going to spend on healthcare, like nobody knows how to rebase them. Like it's really, really difficult. And so that's just the reality of where we are right now. I mean, I think that we are too early. We don't know how this is going to, you know, is it all going to come out in the wash? Does it turn out you underestimated here and you overestimated here? And like, look, if you have a large enough population, it's about the same. Or did people make bets on like certain populations that are now just like crazy off? I mean, we don't know.
In your journey to create human-centered healthcare, what are your strategies for making healthcare usable and useful to humans and patients and clinicians?
Making healthcare easily understood is something that has always been paramount to me. Interestingly, for, you know, perhaps an organization or organizations who technically sell things, like we sell healthcare. That's how we stay alive as a business. You know, even as a nonprofit, that's still, you know, where our bottom line comes from. We often make it difficult to be able to for people to buy what we're selling. And so like it's actually usually kind of hard to find the right provider and to be able to book an appointment with them and, you know, to understand how much things are going to cost. And that's just like healthcare in general. And so bringing transparency and clarity to all of that is something that I think is really important for people to feel like they can trust us at any given point and that we are there to take care of them. Now there's a second layer to this since COVID has happened. And that's a lot around what people have seen and experienced since the crisis. And even if you're not in an area that was hard hit with COVID, everybody has now seen the pictures in the news of hospitals, of healthcare workers that, you know, are looking like they are not the type of place where you want to be. Now, all the health systems I know are working incredibly hard to ensure that they are opening in a way that is absolutely safe for the patients that are coming to them. And it is something that is very, very important. And we also have to understand that we need to rebuild trust and rapport with our communities. And we need to do it in a way that happens before they are coming to us physically. Yep. Because already coming to us physically is going to take faith and trust that we're going to take care of them. And so now how do we extend that ability to build trust and rapport into people's homes in a way that works for them? And so that means that we're going to be able to reach out to people in a way that they understand what is open, what services are available, how to get them. We need to make sure that anything that can be done at home is done at home. And we need to start working towards things like no waiting rooms, because we have the technology that allows us to get very near to that. And so this is the time that we really need to start employing that and understanding that the time where people are coming in physically is something that we are asking a lot of them to do that. And so take that in the utmost respect and really wrap the services around the patient in whatever way we can.
Built towards the new normal, right? we kept talking about the virtual waiting room as opposed to be sitting in the waiting room. Yep. At the time, we were talking about flu and being concerned. Yep. Now it's much more serious. I've been asked this question multiple times. I'd love to hear your answer to it. Has the recent crisis changed telehealth's trajectory going forward, in your opinion?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, how much, I think, is a question. Like, I don't think anybody thinks it's going to stay exactly the same that it is now, but it has changed. You know, we have people who would never have been incentivized to use telemedicine as part of their practice who are using it regularly and, you know, have found that there are many good uses for it for their populations. And now patients have also experienced it, you know, and again, you know, you talk about as a patient, I did as well. My son got an expander, from his orthodontist, literally the Saturday before everything in New York closed. And so we had two subsequent visits with the orthodontist that were FaceTime visits. They worked fantastically. And, you know, in the back of my mind, I was like, goodness gracious, like I would have had to have taken a half a day off work for each one of these visits. And it took us like less than 10 minutes on FaceTime to do it at home.
And if you remember, in those days when we were talking about dentists, like you wouldn't have put them in the first line, right, of people who are going to be using telehealth. And here they are. They're using it. That's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it worked out great. And so, like, as a patient now, you know, I'm just like, well, you know, it's hard to go back. And so it's changed. I think how much it stays changed is going to be related to a whole bunch of different things. One is, you know, as I talked about, the reimbursement and regulatory environment has changed substantially over the last 2 months. I don't think anybody thinks it's going to go back to what it was before, but how much it stays where it is, I think is going to drive a lot of continued adoption going on. And then the second part of it is, you know, I think that there are going to be multiple waves of COVID. I think that there are very few public health professionals who feel like this is one hill that just like goes down across the country. This is probably going to have bumps on the road. And so what those bumps look like and how extended they are is going to give a bunch of us larger organizations time to put more and more infrastructure in place. Yeah. I think that once we get like more solid and tested infrastructure there for larger groups, the more likely they are to continue with it. And hopefully it'll be very good. It'll be a good experience for everybody. And so then they'll can continue that going. It'll see a little bit about those things and what can fall into place.
No, I agree. I've been thinking about this. We used to see, I'm sure you remember, right? If people used it once, they kept coming back and they used it. Now, this has given a lot of many of us the opportunity to use it, just like your, you know, orthodontics experience, right? And once you use it and you actually see that we're able to get to results and get taken care of as a patient, or the other side for the providers who were skeptical to say, wow, I can actually do this through this modality just as well. Of course, not for everything. That I think we're kind of going over that hump as well. So let's talk about from a career perspective, with telehealth being such a critical part of healthcare now, is this now a career in and of itself?
That is a fantastic question. So what is interesting is that, you know, for me, self-reflectively, you know, for many years, I was like, oh, I was the physician you know, who did this. And obviously I was never actually the single one, but you know, there were a few of us who were, you know, champions that had really focused on this. We all know each other. I was on a panel a few weeks ago with, you know, one of the leaders from Cleveland Clinic and then, you know, another one from another telemedicine company called 98.6. And we all like, you know, the physicians in this group kind of all know each other. And all of a sudden, we have tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of colleagues that, you know, can also talk about doing a physical exam and everything. And so, you know, like, what does this mean for a career in this? And so I think that for many people, telemedicine is going to be just another part of the way that they practice. And so it is not going to be something that they dedicate their life to. You know, it is going to be another tool in their toolkit, you know, and that's fantastic. And that's the extent of it. I think that there are definitely, there's more opportunity now as you build out scalable, solid, consumer-friendly, provider-friendly infrastructure that people that are able to work in that and understand that and understand the operations and understand the vision of what needs to be built will have more things to work with, more people to work with, larger scale in order to build those out. And so I think there's a ton of opportunity.
Can people pursue both clinical and non-clinical careers in telehealth?
Absolutely, yeah. And so in fact, I think that you need those crossovers, right? Because, you know, more than once I've talked to somebody from product who said, oh, you know, I had a clinician say they wanted this, I built this, and I looked at it and I was like, you know what, in practice, one of my friends calls it in the wild, you know, it's like in the wild, that's never going to work. And so you need to have it. And then conversely, I was presenting actually to a physician group and, you know, talking about innovation and talking about how I wanted to support them and, you know, specifically this department and if, you know, whatever I could do in innovation to help support them. And someone raised their hand and was just like, yeah, you know, our community physicians are working on a different electronic health record than our hospital. Can you fix the two like electronic health records talking to each other? And it's like, it was, a, you know, from his point of view, like that was a really big problem and innovation should be able to fix that. And I was just like, okay, so it's a little bit more complicated than me as an individual, just like fixing how EHRs talk to each other. And so, you know, just really having the experience of being in both and just like understanding what the needs are and then understanding what's possible and then pushing what's possible is really important.
And, you know, we can always help as Redox for that integration part of the problem.
That's right. I know.
That's why we're here.
It's not just me, it's also Redox, right?
So let's talk about a little bit women. Reports show that although women make a larger percentage of the healthcare workforce and hold more leadership positions than in previous decades, there are still far fewer of us than men in healthcare C-suites. What advice do you have for women in medicine who wish to advance to senior roles?
Another fantastic question. Yeah, it is really interesting. So we have a super supportive environment at Atlantic. Atlantic has one of the higher rates of women in leadership of any health system I've seen. And again, you know, super, super proud of the organization there for pulling that together. It's also one of the reasons that I was attracted to coming to work there. You know, I thought it was great to see the diversity and inclusion. And, you know, I think there are two kind of answers. And one is just keep working at it, which is kind of a hard answer to hear, but you just keep doing a good job and then seek out environments where you do see that women have positions of leadership. Because, you know, there are things you can do to cultivate that environment. And some of them you can do personally and some of them you can build up. And, you know, it's also about, you know, finding fertile ground for you to grow. And so that's also something for organizations to understand as well. Like we have very good women leaders. And, you know, for them to know that women are looking for environments where they have models to show that women are supported in leadership roles is something that's important. And to be able to attract good talent, you have to be able to look around you and say, hey, look, have we really allowed people to flourish no matter of, you know, where they come from, what they wear, you know, what they look like? And it's really about, you know, being good leaders and as best as possible being meritocratic. And if not, like how do we change that to be a supportive environment?
Last question. When you're not treating patients or inventing new ways of delivering healthcare and bringing telehealth to, you know, your health system, how do you unwind?
Ah, yeah. So this is the sailing. I know, right? It's actually fantastic. We really, really like getting out on the water. I think that people in our positions tend to be the types of people that really like to give to our work. And being able to physically separate yourself from land, from cell signals, from everything allows you to disconnect in a way that is sometimes may even be hard if you're trying to get away to like a beach or something like that, you know, where like many people find it relaxing. You're like, beaches still have Wi-Fi nowadays. And so like, Not that your boat usually doesn't either, but you know, you're usually doing something while you're out. And our kids love it. You know, they've practically been born on the water. And so it's great for the entire family. It's great for us for relaxing.
Same for us. And if you go far enough, there is no Wi-Fi.
That's right.
And yeah, I'm the same way. The water relaxes and soothes, you know, soothes me. And then just kind of paying attention to the task at hand, right?
Yep.
And it allows you to kind of separate a little bit. This has been great, Sylvia. Thank you so much. Loved it. And hopefully we'll have you back again for another session.
Thanks so much.
Hey everyone, Nico here again. Huge thanks to Dr. Sylvia Rahm, Chief Innovation Officer of Atlantic Health System, for joining us on today's show. And a special thanks to our guest host this week, Redox Chief Customer Officer, Alif Arajar, for being willing to share their conversation with all of us. Personally, I loved being able to sit back and just consume the show from the sidelines. Final thoughts, even as health systems are scheduling elective procedures again, restaurants are serving food, and the economy is slowly opening back up, let's not get ahead of ourselves. Keep your hands to yourself. And thanks for listening to the Redox podcast.